Coming up on Boston Public Radio, in case you hadn't heard, the Red Sox won the World Series again. We'll open the phone lines for all things Sox as the countdown to Saturday's Duck Boat Parade begins. Then the woman in charge of healthcare.gov says it's a debacle. But has media coverage been just as flawed? The Columbia Journalism Review answers. Then the War of the Worlds scared a nation 75 years ago. Today, the man behind an equally fictitious and scary zombie invasion joins us.
Chris Lydon joins us to talk landed gentry versus working stiff, the theme emerging in this year's Boston Mayor's Race in honor of Halloween. When the trick-or-treaters hit 6'3", is it time they quit begging for candy and go get a job? And then, Kara Miller on nightmare traffic and transportation. Will America ever fix our decrepit roads and bridges? All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Jim Browdy is back. I am Marjorie Eakin. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
I'm back.
You're back.
Red Sox are back. Red Sox Nation has regained its superpower status in 1 year. They went from being a rogue state, undone by chicken, by beer, by Bobby Valentine, to world champions, bolstered by beards and Big Poppy. It's a free-for-all here at Boston Public Radio at 877-301-8970. Sports fans, we want to know what you didn't get done during the World Series, or behind on work, on bills, on sleep. Non-sports fans, are you glad it's over, or did you get into it at the end? And what rules did you break? Did you let the kids stay up late? All things Red Sox at 877-301-8970.
I don't want to tell a tale out of school, but she'll remain unnamed. We have a coworker who showed up this morning with her Red Sox jersey on with the big number and everything. I don't even know what player it is, but she confessed that she sat at home watching the game with that Red Sox jersey on. And then she went to sleep in the jersey.
Wait, you think she's an outlier?
Well, I'm wondering. Maybe she's not. We'll find out. 877-301-8970. Did you, too, wear your jersey at home, wear it to bed, and wear it to work this morning? And, you know, some people do get a little bit carried away, Jim. I don't mean to be judgmental here, but, you know, I know people that sit there watching the game with their catcher's mitt.
You mean at home you're talking about? On the couch?
At home. And they're protective cops. I think that's one step too far.
877-301-8970. Anything Red Sox you want to get out of your system? You all know they announced this morning, the mayor's office did, the Duck Boat Parade is at 10 a.m. on Saturday. Last night they won this whole thing. It is huge. I mean,
could you please quote the mayor on the Duck Parade?
Oh, it's my favorite line.
Favorite line.
I've done it about 1,000 times.
Do it again.
Of the great lines, and I hope he utters it at 10 a.m. on Saturday. He says, "Gentlemen, mount your ducks."
And I love that.
It is a great line. It's going to happen at 10 a.m. I assume the crowds are going to be epic. And you know what everybody's saying. Obviously, this is even more incredible than anything that went before, because these were a bunch of cast-offs, you know, other than the Big Poppies and the John Lesters and the Dustin Pedroias. And that's what I think makes it so endearing. But if you want to talk about the sports aspect, that's fine. We're more interested in sort of the backstory, as I say. Are there things that you just did not do? Everything was on hold while you did it. And by the way, while you're talking about our colleague, by the way, who is a very serious newswoman.
Serious journalist.
Exactly.
She wore her Red Sox shirt to bed.
She did. Well, I don't know if that was inadvertent or if that was just to celebrate the... I guarantee we have this beautiful window that we look out during the day. I guarantee you, if you keep one of your two eyes out on the street, I guarantee you, you'll not forget kids. You will see adults. Every several adults, you'll see somebody with a Red Sox sweatshirt, T-shirt, jersey on. That's what they do.
You know why? Because when we win these things, it's not like the Red Sox won.
I know it is.
We won.
I know.
Even though we didn't hit any baseballs.
No, we didn't.
We didn't catch any baseballs. We weren't anywhere near the baseball field.
We did hook slide into home plate, though, for the 877-301-8970. I have to say, you know, even if you're not a big sports fan, Marjorie promised during the segment, she made a vow to me this morning, she was not going to say her usual, "Yeah, I really don't know much about baseball." You do get caught up in this. The level, it is wildly exciting. Everybody, you know what one of the great things is? I live in a neighborhood, it's not exactly quiet, in Eamon Square in Cambridge, but it's not a raucous, drunken neighborhood or anything like that. One of the great things, after there's any great victory in sports, whether it's the Patriots winning the Super Bowl or the Bruins winning the Stanley Cup, whatever it is, or as Tom Menino said, the Red Sox winning the World Series Cup or whatever it's called.
I know.
All of a sudden, you're either lying in bed, sitting on the couch, at your computer, and you hear this collective roar throughout the neighborhood. It's great. Almost like it is perfectly timed. I assume it was on the final pitch for the final strikeout happened last night. But it's great. There really is this communal feeling that whether you're into the Red Sox or not is pretty great.
Well, I told you how I knew they won.
How?
Because I did fall asleep, and the helicopters, I could hear, woke up.
The
and
news
heard
helicopters,
all these
mean?
Helicopters.
That's great.
And I thought, oh, my God, because I live close to Fenway Park, the news helicopters are here. The Red Sox have won.
Before we get to the calls, we almost always take calls in the order in which they come in. We will make an exception today. If someone listening is one of the people that Marjorie described before, and we know there are a lot of you, who did sit on the couch last night, one, with a catcher's mitt on, and two, with is what she describes a protective cup. Even though you were sitting on the couch,
you were not
on
the
No, it is a protective cup,
okay,
is what it is.
So.
We'd like you to call and explain yourself, if you would. 877-301-8970. The day after and 2 days before, the duck boats roll. I love also Menino. He coined the phrase, right? Rolling rally. Which it is.
It's another rolling rally.
It is a great.
Well, they had the first one down at City Hall Plaza. It was a disaster. Remember when the Patriots
won? You were
won?
There for that.
Yes,
freezing your whatever off.
It was freezing. And people were waiting for a long time. It was about 5 degrees.
Now, this is brilliant, actually. I love
the rolling
idea.
Rally is the way to do
Excuse
it.
Excuse me. It's not a rolling rally.
Rolling rally. The rolling rally because you can, of course, line the streets and the duck boats roll as opposed to winding up in City Hall Plaza like they did for the Patriots. Anyway.
Let's do it.
George from Taunton, are you in a euphoric state, George?
Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoyed baseball, and I enjoyed the World Series, and I'm glad they won. But I'm curious if the alignment of the moon, the stars, and what have you that allowed this victory to happen, I wonder if there's any hope for us Dallas Cowboys fans so we can come from the basement and maybe win something.
I don't think so. As long as Jerry Jones is there, I think you're doomed to failure, George.
George, you didn't watch the games with a catcher's mitt in your hand, did you?
No, actually, I'm a truck driver. I listen to him on a station out of Chicago.
Okay.
WMPV out of Chicago.
Okay. Oh, just checking. I heard that George from Taunton, you know, wears his Red Sox shirt. Where he goes. It must
Maybe
be a different
does.
George.
You can do that
Could
when
be a
drive.
Different George
Hey, George,
from Taunton.
Thank you for your call. 877-301-8970. Philip Martin this morning did a piece on our station about all the people who are not of Red Sox Nation, out-of-towners, those sort of things, who just get into it. It's hard. How do you not get into it? I mean, there is almost nothing that is anything but wonderful at a time. Like, people are all upbeat. People are great. The beard thing, even though they're the foulest-looking beards, probably in the history of beards.
Foul.
But it's just this really uplifting, wonderful thing. You know, the only thing I don't like, I have to say,
what?
I love in other sports where when the championship game is over, particularly in hockey. I love hockey. Even though I'm not a big hockey fan, I love the hockey players. They shake hands. You know, they skate by each other.
Oh, yeah, they don't do that.
I would like to, wouldn't it be great if the 25 guys for the Red Sox, plus the coaches, walked over midfield, or what they don't call midfield, whatever, the pitcher's mound, and shook hands with the St. Louis people?
That would
be
lovely.
Really nice.
That would be a lovely gesture, Jim.
It's not happening.
Why don't you write to John Henry?
What?
Why don't you write to John Henry and see what he can do for you?
We've invited him. If you're listening, John Henry, we're waiting. No, we're dying to talk to him about the Globe, the Red Sox. Let's go to East Boston, which obviously has a big vote coming on Tuesday. Herb, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
All right. I just want to start off saying I am originally from St. Louis, and of course, I rooted for the Cardinals to win the World Series.
Sorry.
Yeah, it didn't happen, but it was a great series. I got to watch it with all my in-laws on the couch, and I got to tweet and, you know, Facebook with all my family and friends at home, and everyone enjoyed it. The players from Boston were amazing, and so were the players from St. Louis. It was a big, you know, camaraderie thing. There was a lot of respect, and you know, the better team won, so congratulations to Boston.
Herb, you are the stereotypical St. Louis type, though. We hear, I've never been to St. Louis, that everybody is as nice as you are, that you never...
It's a fantastic town.
Listen to this.
Really,
you never boo your own players, and now you're complimenting the team that vanquished your team.
Well, I mean, in St. Louis, there's a very much... there's a different mentality about it. I mean, it's competition, of course, and we don't want to give anything away. But at the same time, if you're good enough to hang with us, then you must got something special going on. So, you know, you deserve respect.
Don't you wish you were like Herb,
yes.
Marjorie?
Meet me
Herb,
in St.
You're a good
Louis.
Soul. Thank
Absolutely.
You for the call. We appreciate it.
We have a couple of emails at bpr@wgbh.org on the Red Sox matter. Keith is correcting us. You said that the mayor called it a rolling rally.
Rolling rally.
Keith says he called it a roving rally. Is that correct?
No, he didn't. He actually called it a rolling rally.
That's what Keith says. And Stephen says about sleeping in his Red Sox t-shirt. Mm-hmm. He did not sleep in his Red Sox t-shirt. He did, however, sleep with a baseball bat. But nothing to do with the Sox. There have been a few break-ins in the neighborhood, and he had to be ready.
Thank you. 877-301-8970. It's the morning after, and we're taking all things Sox on the phone. You want to talk about your kids staying up too late? You want to talk about you and your coworkers being bleary-eyed? Were you standing outside Fenway? By the way, if anybody was lucky enough to get inside, needless to say, Marjorie and I were not amongst the privileged few. We'd love to hear from you, too. Let's go to Vicky in the car. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking all things Sox with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Thanks for taking my call, and I was one of those lucky few who got to be inside the park.
Good for you.
So what was that like? How great was that?
It was electric. It was electric from the moment you stepped into the park until that last strike was made. It was something that just brought this whole city together. You just felt such a camaraderie.
Yeah.
And I really think what the Red Sox provided after the marathon bombing was something positive, a way for us to heal, something to look forward to and move forward. And the team was just so great. You know, the personalities were so warm.
I agree with that.
Approachable, I guess.
Well, you know, there's a lot of expectation. We don't know that for sure that they will be part of the rolling rally. Will include some of the people
marathon
from the
survivors.
Marathon that are interested in being there. I bet that's going to happen. Don't you think, Vicky? Oops.
Vicky, you there?
Is Vicky gone?
I'm still here.
Okay. Now, Vicky, I am guessing, based upon the quality of your call and the tenor of your voice, that you too, like our colleagues, slept in your Red Sox gear. Is that a safe assumption?
Well, honestly, I was a very reluctant baseball fan. When I married my husband, I hated watching baseball, and I just thought it was nasty how they would focus on somebody sitting with their camera.
But you got over it, right?
I did get over it, and I just love the whole team spirit of it. I know why people go to sleep in their Red Sox shirts. They're exhausted and they don't have the energy to change.
That may be a decent point. Vicky, congratulations, and I guess you for winning.
Are you still wearing the shirt, Vicky, or did you change this morning?
You know, I've got my spider sweater on.
Your spider sweater?
My spider sweater.
Oh, okay.
We want to ask you to explain. It's okay. Vicky, thank you for the call.
I would guess it's a spider sweater for Halloween, Jim.
What percentage of Halloween costumes will have a Red Sox theme in Greater Boston tonight, would you say?
I would imagine it'll be huge.
Huge.
Yeah, it'll be a very big thing.
How many people do you think are going as healthcare.gov? I don't know how you do that, but it seems to me if you want to be really scary, you dress up as the website. I just don't know how that manifests
itself. That's very good.
Thank
that's
you.
Very
I appreciate
good.
Your support.
Apparently, Despicable Me costumes from those movies.
Huge.
Those kids' movies are huge this year. You know what else is huge?
No.
Miley Cyrus costumes.
Is that really true?
Yes. Twerking Miley Cyrus is going to be at your door tonight about 6 o'clock, Jim. Watch out. Jerry from South Hingham. What do you think, Jerry?
Hi. It's South Weymouth, nonetheless.
Oh, sorry. South Weymouth.
We were so excited about last night, we didn't even know you were from where you're from. Go ahead.
Me too. I'd just like to start an explanation, say the first baseball game I ever listened to, that I can remember anyway, was in 1946 when those good old Cardinals beat the Red Sox. And as I remember it, at the age of about 9, Ted Williams struck out with the bases loaded in the 9th and the Cardinals won 4-3.
Oh.
I've never checked that, so maybe I'm wrong. So anyway, I don't want to be a curmudgeon, and I'm just thrilled to death that they did this and went from last to first, and, you know, Cinderella gets a glass slipper and all that sort of thing. I think it's great. What I don't understand is why people think that to celebrate such a remarkable achievement, they have to turn over a car or do some other act of total heinous vandalism to express themselves.
Well, that did, for whatever it's worth, it was an attempt to turn over a car. I think it's on Boylston Street. But I hate to defend, and I'm surely not defending people who came close to perpetrating violence. But it was pretty limited. The police really had control of this thing. The vast majority of people, Jerry, which doesn't excuse the behavior of the few, acted totally responsibly, other than maybe having a couple too many drinks. So let's leave that for today. And Jerry, thanks for the walk down memory lane, and thank you for the call. 877-301-897. I'm glad nothing bad did happen. I mean, there could have been something troubling. About my understanding is the police officers actually stopped the car turner overers from succeeding in their task.
Well, they were very, very well prepared. I was driving home yesterday around 4:30 or so, and already on Beacon Street, past Fenway, heading up into Brookline, they had blocked off all the parking spaces. Mm-hmm. There were all these signs there, you can't park there. So, and they had the police barriers. They were very ready and for bad things to happen. And happily, for the most part, bad things did not happen.
Sean and Gardner, you're on with Jim and Marjorie. We're talking Sox championship here on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Sean.
Is it okay if it's John, not Sean?
Oh, John. How
Hi,
are
John.
You? Do me a favor, John. When you're done, if you can give the phone to Sean, we'll talk to him too. Is that okay?
He's pretty funny. I want to get him on too.
Thank you. What's up, John?
Jim, do you remember the old stirrup socks baseball players used to wear before they all started wearing it? And explain that to Marjorie when I'm done. But Marjorie,
yeah,
you also used to wear some high white sanitary socks under the stirrup socks?
They did?
Yeah, so I wore my white sanitary socks, my stirrup socks, my Red Sox cap, my catcher's mask, and nothing else watching the game last night.
Good for you, John.
I love that look, by the way, John.
Explain to the audience what stirrup socks were.
Well, you explain to the audience. Those things, they were high toppers, and they just, did they connect to buttons on the bottom of the pants of the uniforms?
No.
Is that what they do?
Garter belts?
No, they just went high up, in the old days, probably up over your knees.
I love, by the way, some occasionally, I don't know if you're allowed to do this in the major leagues. I know if you depart from the traditional uniform, you occasionally get fined in some sports. Yeah. But every once in a while, when they're doing throwback uniforms and that sort of thing,
right.
They wear them. I love that look. I totally, because now the pants come down like pants you wear when you're walking down the street. So it was a great look. John, I'd love, send me a photo of you in the catcher's mask and nothing else.
I hope you took a selfie, John.
I'll send it to Marjorie.
Okay.
Yes, I'm sure you are. Let's
right,
go to
John,
Ed and Lynn.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Ed. You're on Boston Public Radio.
Hello, Jim and Margie.
Hey.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about how hard it was yesterday to go to Beth Israel. My daughter is at the NICU with the newborn intensive care unit there.
Oh.
And I live in Everett. It's only supposed to be 10 minutes away, and I had to get to the NICU. And it took me about an hour, and we had to keep going around the Longwood Avenue area trying to get to a cop that will let us get into so I could see my daughter and be there with my daughter. So it was really frustrating to be treated with such disrespect and disregard by the Boston police. I'm sure they did a great job keeping people safe during that time. And, I mean, I lost the Sox. Everybody lost the Sox. But they should think about these things before closing off the area where all the major hospitals
are. Yeah, obviously.
And people that are really at the edge. And the people are just going through such hard moments in their lives, and it would be nice if they made it a little bit easier for us.
How's your kid, by the way?
She's doing all right. She was born premature a couple of weeks. She had Down syndrome and a congenital heart defect, the child just below. But she's strong. She's really strong, and she's getting better every day. But what she really needs so she can go home is to feed and breast her mother's breast milk is a lot better than formula.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, I'm doing these late runs to the hospital to try to, we're trying to pump as much as we can and running there just to be able to get this milk to her so she can get strong so she can go home.
Ed, we wish her luck, and it sounds like she's got a pretty good dad. So good luck. I'm really sorry for the inconvenience. Can you imagine? I mean, if you're in that spot, it's pretty horrible.
Yeah.
Ed, thanks for the call.
Yeah, you think that they would say, okay, come through or tell Ed how to get there on an alternative route.
I know,
that's too bad.
Luckily, things turned out okay. Final one on this. Joyce, you're in a car. You're on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the Red Sox. Hi, Joyce.
Yeah. Oh, hi. What can I say? I can't compare with that. But I think it's generally what you already said is that these guys aren't what everybody sees the Yankees as or whatever. It's ultimate perfection. Plenty of money, never make a mistake. It's they're guys that, they come from almost nowhere. You don't, like, one guy wasn't even supposed to be batting, and he ended up batting it, doing like a double or whatever with runs batted in. And it's you can identify with them. I mean, most of us. I'm not perfect, and I don't succeed all the time. And most of my friends, it's the same feeling that these guys, they struggle, and they screw up, and they're not expected to do super well all the time, and they're not all these handsome, you know, perfect superheroes. But they put it together, and they keep trying, and they don't give up, and they make it. And that is what myself and, you know, I'm a child psychiatrist, and it's the one thing that you try to put in everybody is that you've got to keep trying, and you got to not give up, and you're going to have horrible things in your life, and you're not going to always succeed, but keep believing in yourself. And if you believe in yourself and you get together and you're generous and you give to each other, that you can succeed.
Joyce,
and they're
that
like
is great.
The living embodiment of this.
That
and,
is
and
great.
And there's no other team like this.
That, is
you know,
that was a great call. That was a great call, Joyce. Terrific.
I'll be less inspirational than Joyce was, but the examples of this, the guy who had the three-run double last night, Victorino, I think was 0 for 10, hadn't gotten a hit in the World Series. The guy who hit the home run shortly after him, Stephen Drew, was the most reviled, inept batter. He'd gone like 4 for 40-something
yeah.
in the World Series, and he hits a home run. It's really true. It's pretty great.
Were you wearing a baseball cap and a catcher's mitt watching the
no,
game?
No, just a protective cup. Nothing. Just. I mean, okay. If you ask... I'm sorry. But let me tell you, I didn't get hit. I mean, that's it
good,
worked. It was really
that's good.
Worked out
I'm glad
fine.
You're safe and sound.
Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, we'll look at the other big news of yesterday. President Barack Obama's Boston appearance and his pep talk about the Affordable Care Act. What is the truth behind the PR push? That conversation up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Yesterday, something else was happening. From Faneuil Hall, the birthplace of our own state's affordable health care legislation, Barack Obama pitched the Affordable Care Act to the nation.
I am well aware that a presidential visit is not the biggest thing going on today in Boston. I tried to grow a beard, but Michelle, she wasn't having it. When he sat down at a computer, and I'm sure after multiple tries, signed up for a new plan under the Affordable Care Act.
Now, of course, that was against the backdrop of his own health secretary testifying before Congress and calling the website itself, quote, a debacle. Joining us to talk through what Obamacare works about it, what doesn't, and what the media have been missing in covering the law is Trudy Lieberman. Trudy's a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, where she blogs about health care and the coverage of health. Welcome back, Trudy.
Thank you.
Hi, Trudy. Great, great pieces on this whole mess. But I'm wondering, because you know, you've reported on this extensively, everybody's criticized Obama, of course, everybody's criticized Kathleen Sebelius. You criticized the press for our coverage of this. Tell us some of the things that we did wrong.
I think the biggest thing the media did wrong, looking at it over the last several years now, is they didn't explain honestly what Obamacare would do and would not do. And I think that had they done that, some of the backlash would have been thrown away. It wouldn't have been so hard to debunk it. It might not have even happened. But I think people didn't understand the law. They didn't know what it would do. They didn't know who it would apply to. And even today, there's a lot of confusion and distrust and misplaced information about what it really will do or who it will affect. And I think that is the biggest criticism that I can level against the media. And the media was generally following what the president and Sebelius and many others were doing to promote the law. And, you know, we in the press follow politicians sometimes, and perhaps more than we should. And so there wasn't a lot of digging and sort of looking at the claims about what would really happen. And I think the issue of this affordable coverage was probably one of the biggest oversights in the media. Most of us knew right off the bat that even though he was making these claims, and the administration still does, saying that people are going to get affordable quality health care. That was a slogan that their pollsters had come up with long before this law really ever saw the light of Congress, or the bill saw the light of Congress. And so they've been excellent at continuing to foster that. Now, the truth is that some people will get affordable care that they affordable insurance that they don't have now, but many others will not. And so
Excuse me, Trudy, when you say that, are you talking about the people that are in those states where they refuse to expand Medicaid, or are you talking about just in general across the board, people won't be able to get affordable care, certain people won't be able to?
In general, across the board, and then a particular subset of the population, those people who have very, very low incomes, below 100% of the poverty level, in states that are not expanding Medicaid, will have almost no options at all. And for them, care and coverage is totally unaffordable.
Well, the one thing also that it appears the press bought hook, line, and sinker was this notion that if you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan. And while everybody now is doing one of those Captain Renault things in Rick's cafe in Casablanca, at least from what I've been reading, if people went back and looked at the regulations that were promulgated in the year after the Affordable Care Act became law, they would have seen that there were probably going to be a ton of people, CBS News says 2 million already, who are going to get cancellation notices, correct?
Well, there's two ways to look at this. People, we knew at the beginning that people were not going to be able to keep what they have. 160 million Americans are in the employer market. Their employers pay for most of their coverage. Those plans for those people change every year, and people in those markets know what it's like to have to change policies every year or every couple of years because the employer gets a new plan, a cheaper plan, one that might cover less, one that gives more cost sharing to the worker. Those changes were happening long before the Affordable Care Act was passed. So we're really talking about a small group of people who have to shop in the individual marketplace. And even there's a subset of those people who had policies before the law was passed would be grandfathered into the law, and they could keep those policies. Many of those policies were not very good in terms of benefits and coverage. The new policies that they may be offered now are really much better because they have to conform to the 10 minimum essential benefits. Nevertheless, those people in some cases are quite upset because they have a cheap policy. Maybe they didn't really care about better coverage, and so some of them are squawking now. But the regulations were changed along the way so that if the policy, you had an old policy in this individual market and you changed it substantially, like changed the deductible, increased the deductible, those plans would lose grandfathered status. And those are the ones that people have now that are seeing the cancellation notices on.
So, Trudy Lieberman, were the press's failures, I know this is a broad stroke, but do with it what you will, a function of ideology? Because, as we know, the reports suggest that the vast majority of reporters in this country actually support the president or at least voted for the president. Or is it laziness or something else?
I think it's just the way the press has become in this country right now. I wouldn't say it was ideology at this point. Many in the media actually supported the Affordable Care Act, and they were quite open about it. So I wouldn't say it was that. I think they just were not well-versed in insurance, well-versed in what really could happen, and didn't bother to really look at what was in this law and sort of go beyond what the political talking points were. I think that was really the problem.
Well, I wonder, having been in newspapers my whole life, whether part of it, Trudy, is that we have so few people left that reporters who had the time and the luxury to really dig into things at a deep level don't have that time or luxury anymore. We're just going to see more and more of this as the budgets for investigations or even long-form reporting shrinks. But I want to ask you something. You said in one of your pieces that there's that this whole plan is not wholesale reform, but just another patch on America's patchwork healthcare system. That's a really depressing quote. Just another patch on the patchwork quilt. Is it really that bad?
Well, what we did not do, we did not change the delivery system. The delivery system remains in private hands, private delivery of healthcare services. And we did not come up with a universal national healthcare system like many other countries have, where people are entitled to insurance as a matter of right. We still will have millions of people uninsured even after this is fully implemented and all the kinks get worked out, which they will, and things settle down. And so to really reform the system, those two things might have had to change, and they didn't change. We only dealt with one aspect of the healthcare system, and that was the individual market. And so we added a few more preventive benefits to Medicare. We expanded Medicaid greatly, and that will contribute to a lot more people getting insurance if the half of the other states get on board with the program. But we really didn't change some of the fundamentals of the system. We still have private insurance and will continue to have, even under this exchange. And what we are seeing is that there is continuing to be a cost shift from the payer, which might be employers in this case we're talking about, to the consumer or the patient. And so patients are going to see that they're going to have to bear a lot more of the cost burden. The ACA does cap out-of-pocket spending, but those can be high for certain families. $12,700 for a family of four if those limits were in effect in 2014, which they won't be. They'll be in effect in 2015. So one could argue that people will still face some substantial out-of-pocket costs.
Well, of course, the president would say, Trudy, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. At least he got universal health care. We talked about the cancellation issue and the potential that affordable may not be as affordable for some, and the media should have captured that. Did the media do a better job assessing the notion that this website may not be in as good a shape as people like Marilyn Tavener, the woman who's head of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and Kathleen Sebelius were assuring people? Should the media have been more on top of that issue before it exploded?
I think so, because it was sort of well known in Washington that that site was not ready for prime time. I knew about it from insurance sources at the end of the summer, and I'm sure other reporters in Washington knew about it as well. Why they didn't cover it and why they continue to present the assurances from the Department of Health and Human Services, I don't know. But I think that they did a disservice by doing that. Because
did you write about it? You said you knew. Did you write about it?
No, I did not.
Why didn't you?
Because I generally don't cover the technical issues.
I see.
You know, Trudy, I wondered, this other big thing that you hear all the time now is that everybody's premiums are going up, whether they're, you know, working with their employer and getting insurance through them, or whether they're just buying in the individual. Why is that?
You mean their share of the premiums?
Yes, premiums are going up. They're going up from, you know, whatever it is, $600 a month to $800 a month or whatever. Why is that?
Because the underlying cost of care keeps rising. We have more procedures. We have more high technology, which we want as a country, and patients want it. All this costs a lot of money. There are new pharmaceuticals coming on the market, and it's this underlying pressure that continues to keep the price up for insurance. And there's not a lot of pressure on the other side to sort of put the brakes on the providers.
You know, Trudy, when you're listing a couple of minutes ago, we're talking to Trudy Lieberman from the Columbia Journalism Review. When you're talking about some of the elements of the law and some of the elements that weren't reported on, what obligation does the press have to present this in user-friendly ways? Because part of the problem of this is, one, it is daunting in terms of complexity and volume. And two, as I've said on the show about 4,000 times, it's not like you're choosing a phone company. You're choosing something that has real immediate impact on you, your family, the people you love, that sort of thing. What obligation does the media have to ensure that not only they get the information out, but they do it in such a way that real people can consume it and use it?
I think they have a huge obligation, and I spent most of my career as a consumer reporter, and I have been urging in my post that what is needed now is good old-fashioned consumer reporting, how-to stories, telling people how to make those trade-offs every step of the way. You are right. It's a terribly complex decision, and it involves that we have to think about risk, and we're not very good at assessing risk. What illnesses are we going to have in the next year? That determines what kind of policy we get this year, and we don't really know that.
You know, Trudy, we have an interesting email from Art from West Bridgewater who says that actually a lot of this information about how the healthcare system was a mess was reported, but it was reported on Fox News and very conservative blogs and stuff like that, and that other people in the mainstream media kind of ignored it. So is that right? Were the right-wing predictors of doom correct about this, and the mainstream press just poo-pooed it because it was from an ideological perspective?
What is the it you're talking about?
Well, it in terms of, you know, you're not going to be able to keep your doctor. I mean, that was the thing that people fed on Fox News. Oh, no, you're not going to be able to keep your doctor.
Fox also told us there are going to be death panels.
Well, they did tell us that. Well, that was Sarah Palin who said there are going to be death panels.
But
they were predicting these bad things, like your premium's going to go up, it's going to cost more for small businesses. They were saying all these things. Is he correct about that?
Well, I think you have to look at the perspective that they're coming from. I mean, they are going to pull out whatever threads or little shreds of truth that might be in any of this. And there are many truths in all of this, and slant them for their own way. I mean, that has been going on in that press for a very long time.
You know, I want to pick up on what you said a minute ago about this how-to thing. You know, whenever I don't understand an issue, which sadly is more frequently than I'd like to admit, the Washington Post, in my opinion, I'm curious to know what you think, almost always has the Q&A that breaks down the complex into accessible chunks for people. But I am so with you, Trudy Lieberman. The notion every paper should do this on things that affect all of us, whether it's, you know, what we should do with Syria a couple of months ago to the Affordable Care Act. I think it's a great idea. One last thing from me. One of the things I assume the press is attempting to get to the bottom of, but with mixed success, is the administration refuses to release the number of people who have actually enrolled. And Kathleen Sebelius told the Commerce and Energy Committee, I think it was yesterday, well, the reason we're not doing it is because the data is not accurate, is not reliable. It will be reliable by November 15th. Would some good, what's that expression, shoe leather work, whatever that expression is, should the press be able to get to the bottom of that before the administration deigns to allow us to know the facts?
They can try. There may be maybe some real issues on the side of HHS. Maybe the what they've captured is messed up because the system has been so messed up. But I do think the press has an obligation to kind of look at that and see what has been going on and find out what has been going on in the states. And in those states that have their own exchanges, lots of people have been signing up, and I think those data are available, and we can find out what's happened in California, New York, Connecticut, Nevada, some of the states that have set their own exchanges, and they've been working fairly well.
So, Trudy Lieberman, one last question for me. You are writing for Columbia Journalism Review, which does, of course, do a great job looking at journalism. At the beginning of this conversation, you talked about how that many reporters were in favor of the Affordable Care Act or so-called Obamacare, and so maybe didn't criticize it as harshly as they should. So those are the more liberal type people, perhaps. On the other hand, you had the more conservative people saying it's going to be terrible. So is the takeaway here that this was an ideologically driven discussion of Obamacare, with each side presenting its own version in hoping to prevail and get the law passed or not get the law passed?
I think you might be able to draw that conclusion.
Yeah, that's pretty depressing, isn't it?
Hey, Trudy.
Well, I mean, I think it should have been explained from the get-go what exactly what it was going to do, what it's not going to do, It was never going to be national health insurance
right.
like they have in France or Germany. But it was going to make some good changes in the individual market. And that is what should have been explained, and with a lot more clarity. Why do we need the individual mandate? Because people are going to have to buy insurance, and why it was necessary. And things as basic as that were really not put out there in ways that people could absorb it.
You know, when you say that, I'm just thinking as we end this, Trudy, is when we couldn't even get an agreement between the presidential candidates whether or not the Affordable Care Act was based on the basic principles of RomneyCare here in Massachusetts or not, you say to yourself, the public is really behind the eight ball. In any case, Trudy Lieberman, thanks so much for your work and thanks so much for your time as always.
Thank you very much.
Trudy Lieberman, who's done great reporting on healthcare for the Columbia Journalism Review, is a contributing editor there, where she also blogs about healthcare and the coverage of health. Okay, when we come back, to mark the convergence of Halloween and the 75th anniversary of War of the Worlds, we're going to look at how a Harvard doctor unleashed a 21st century radio panic about zombies. That conversation up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Yesterday, as I assume you know, was the 75th anniversary of the War of the Worlds, the great Orson Welles radio drama, which created panic attacks across the nation over a Martian invasion. Well, today is Halloween. What better way to mark this convergence than to talk with Dr. Steve Schlossman? He recently wrote a great piece for the New York Times entitled "The Harvard Doctor Who Accidentally Unleashed a Zombie Invasion." Steve Schlossman is that doctor. He's a practicing physician at MGH, an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and the author of "The Zombie Autopsies." Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Happy Halloween, Steve.
Thank you. Same deal.
So tell this story. About 2 years ago, you go on this popular coast-to-coast radio show.
You ever heard of Marjorie?
No, I have not.
It is great, but go ahead.
Well, I'm going to listen to it tonight. It's great. And caused a near panic about a zombie apocalypse. Now, how did this happen, please?
Well, I'm happy to tell you. So we have to lead with this caveat that zombies aren't real. They don't exist. I feel compelled because I took an oath and all that.
I wasn't sure after I saw the Brad Pitt movie. I thought maybe, maybe they did.
Well, Brad Pitt exists, and unfortunately for all the rest of the guys on Earth, but not zombies. So here's what happened. Coast to Coast is a very cool radio program, and on the weekends, this wonderful host named Ian Punnett hosts it, and it's in the wee hours of the morning. So this was like 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning Eastern time. And we played it straight. So we decided, as he's done not a lot, but with some books, he did this with World War Z, for that matter. He acts as if what you're saying actually really happened, and you got to riff with him. So he'll say, "Where did you come across this manuscript?" And you can't say, "Well, I wrote it." So you say, I found it on a robo server from Southeast Asia, and I'm a little worried who might be listening. And we were having a good time going back and forth, and really didn't think that anybody would take it seriously.
But what was the it? What did you describe?
We described this novel I wrote, and in the novel, there's this horrific new plague. That I had a name for. It was called ataxic neurodegenerative satiety deficiency syndrome, ANSD. I sort of made it up, but it describes the behavior of the sort of classic shambling zombies that people like George Romero made famous. I described how it came about, how we treat it, how did it come about? Well, in my book, and this is a sort of spoiler alert, it comes about because you don't know this for a fact, but we're led to believe that evil, nefarious hedge fund managers created it,
I love it,
to help the market to plunge, and then they could bet against the market. But, of course, the genie gets out of the bottle.
I love it.
So you're telling us. Go ahead.
Yeah, so you tell the story. You're on the radio.
Yep.
And then what happens after that?
Well, even as that, not just after that, but during that, in the wee hours of the morning, I start getting emails. Because it's not that hard to find my email address online because I'm a physician at a big hospital. So people were writing, what do I do? Is this real? I mean, you're a doctor and you're on the radio and you're talking about zombies, so it must be real. And how do I protect my house? What's the best vaccines? Does the rest of the country know about this threat? It got active. There were some people who then realized I was messing around, and they actually got kind of mad at me and were like, how dare you do this? You have a responsibility as a physician. You really can't be on the radio at 2 a.m. you know, on a show that does this anyhow, talking about zombies. And so we actually stopped it a little bit short on the Coast to Coast show and sort of came clean and said, here's what we're doing.
Because you were reading these emails as the show was going on? Because yeah, you realized people were taking it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole bunch of things that added that went into that decision. But among them were the fact that I was, you know, we'd go to a commercial and they'd say, how's it going? I'd say, fine, but I'm getting these notes. And they'd say, oh, well, maybe we had to do something about it.
How'd your bosses feel about this? Since you are a real physician, this is not a fictional doctor thing. You right. are a real doc.
Right. It's easier for me to discuss how my mom felt about it, but we'll go to doctors in a sec. So my bosses had almost universally positive feelings. There are a few who said, Steve, are you sure you really want to do this with your reputation? But what's been sort of fascinating for me is it's actually helped. I mean, not my reputation per se, but it's helped my field about which I care deeply. Nobody has thought that I am thinking of my patients as zombies. No one has thought that. Instead, it's been a way to sort of teach neuroscience using this construct. Which
how
is
do you
cool.
wait? How does it help you teach neuroscience?
So what you do is you show. I don't do this with the med students, but I'll do it for the student interest groups, and I'll do this in high schools and colleges. I'll do it tomorrow for Emory on a Skype thing. You show them a video clip from Night of the Living Dead, and you say, those are not zombies. Those are people wandering down the street. What's going on? What's wrong with them? And then if you think about the brain, as I do, you ask them what regions of the brain are responsible.
So I want to know, you also teach psychiatry, you're assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. So I wonder, as a psychiatrist, if you thought about, because most of us don't think zombies are real, and even if we heard it on a radio show, we wouldn't think they were real. Is there a sort of person that's more likely to fall for this? Or is there some kind of anxiety yourself that would make you think the zombies are going to come invade your house or what?
No, it's a great question. So I always, you know, at Comic-Con every year, they say, when will the zombie apocalypse happen? I've been on the panels the last few years, and I always say it's not going to happen, and they all boo. And I figure we're humans, so we have all sorts of ways of doing ourselves in besides zombies. Mm-hmm. We don't need zombies to do it. So I don't think it's so much that we think that they're real, or certainly that I don't think that they're real, but they speak to certain kind of archetypal, universal fears that are characteristic of the modern world.
You know, you made a wonderful point, by the way, about marketing, for lack of a better expression, a fictitious thing which in the light of day seems outrageous. But if the form is right and the time is right, it's much more believable. Make that point, if you would.
Yeah, so a bunch of things. So when you look at the study of hoaxes that or intentional or unintentional hoaxes, things that folks end up believing that they didn't think they would believe, you have the sort of authority of the radio or the main modality by which information's gotten across. And then when it's nighttime, you're just more prone to believe these things. It's dark out. You can't really check up on the data. So you don't have another way of verifying or unverifying what you think you're hearing. So you have all these things that contribute to the verisimilitude of what you're saying, the authority, the person speaking, the host, the fact that it's on the radio at all, and the wee hours of the morning.
Yeah, but you went on to say, you just said a minute ago, Steve Schlossman, you said that, you know, you don't have, realistically, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're not going to go online and check out the veracity of something. But you make a great point that if you do go online to check out the veracity of a hoax like this, for example, a zombie invasion, what do you get?
Well, this is why I wrote the piece. When these emails start coming in to the Coast to Coast folks and to myself, I thought, you know, this reminds me of what I read about the War of the Worlds stuff. I went into the government archives. I read what the advice was, which was, geez, we can't vet every story that goes online or goes on the radio, I'm sorry, or TV for that matter. But we should give the public a way to easily verify what's going on.
This is at the time. This is contemporaneous.
Were in the congressional hearings. There was a senator from Iowa, actually, who led this sort of push. So they basically recommended something that today might be seen as the internet. The problem is that the internet gives you what you want to know. So it engages in kind of technologically driven confirmation bias. You want evidence for there being zombies. You type, are zombies real? It will give you all of the answers that zombies are real. And the more you type that, the more it's going to think that's what you're interested in. So it's going to start ranking those searches at higher levels. That's why my computer, as I wrote in the piece, if I type in the word food and put images for a Google search, it'll show me a salmonella bug.
Yeah. So, you know, and why there's so much, as you point out in your piece that people believe there was this conspiracy to topple the Twin Towers yep. by Americans and then blame it on terrorists and all the links between vaccines and these terrible illnesses. You know, I wonder, you know, you're a practicing physician at MGH, pretty serious hospital. As I said before, you're at Harvard Medical School, pretty serious medical school. How did you veer off into zombies? I mean, how did you arrive at this place?
Oh, yeah, I love all horror movies. I always have since I was a kid.
Oh, yeah? Couple of favorites?
Sure. Well, I love Dawn of the Dead. I know that feels like a gimme given that it's a zombie movie, but it is really one of my very favorite movies. I snuck into it when I was 11 years old, and I told my parents I'd seen The Jerk and snuck into that in Shawnee Mission, Kansas, where I grew up. I love Salem's Lot. It's one of the scariest things I've ever seen. It was a made-for-TV movie, but it is really scary. I mean, that vampire claws on the outside window.
Ooh.
And what's interesting, actually, is people who like scary movies actually like being afraid and then like thinking about why they're afraid. So I've always loved this trope, this idea of scary stories. If it's too scary, if it's like mean people doing mean things, that's harder for me. So slasher films, I'm not as into.
Yep.
And because I have kids, when little kids get hurt, I have a hard time with that, although it wasn't so hard before I had kids. The idea of some kind of redemptive process from friends coming together and fighting off that which would otherwise not be fight-offable, I love those stories. I could watch them forever.
So, you know, Marjorie before put the question about belief and people believing these things in the context of you're a shrink, you're this, whatever. But the reality is virtually every preposterous thing when a survey is done, there's a huge percentage of Americans who are perfectly mentally well, yep. who believe in these things. I mean, I don't know what we do.
In zombies?
No, have you seen any polling? My guess, every time we do something like this through the years, Marjorie, there's a 40% floor. 40% of Americans
they do?
Believe. What percentage of people believe zombies are real?
Well, I can't speak directly to the zombie one. I think it's probably gone up slightly with The Walking Dead. Or if we rephrase the question, the possibility that a zombie outbreak could occur, that's actually much higher.
What are we talking about? A third of the people?
Third, yeah.
Wow.
These aren't formal studies. These are sort of informal.
By the way,
surveys.
Do you know, I saw the crosstab in that poll. Uh-huh. Of those 33%, 79% support Ted Cruz. You know,
right.
Is that amazing?
This is actually a really important point. I get really worried about those folks. I mean, I don't want people arming up for a zombie apocalypse. I don't want them arming up, period, but I certainly don't want them arming up for a zombie apocalypse.
Well, you're part of the problem, though.
Well, exactly. Let's expand this a little bit. What about vampires? Are they real?
Vampires are not real.
Okay.
But, you know, interestingly enough, vampire, or the construct of the vampire, almost every culture has that construct in some way. Zombies, as we think of them, the Romero zombies, which weren't even called zombies, by the way, in the beginning. They were called ghouls, and then one of the Hollywood magazines called them zombies.
Yep.
That's the only American-made, purely movie-generated monster that has a lifespan on, you know, in future stories. Vampires have been around for a long time.
Wait, how long is the Steve Schlossman? How old is the term zombie? Is a relatively new creation?
No, the term zombie is an old one. It's actually Creole for ghost, it comes from the sort of Eastern East Africa, West Islands.
So what were you just saying? What was the point you were just making?
So when George Romero, with whom I'm good friends, made Night of the Living Dead, it was in 1968. He was the chief cameraman for Mr. Rogers, believe it or not.
Oh, that is great.
George is a lovely, lovely man, super smart, super fun, really one of my favorite people. He made this movie. He wanted to sort of create a metaphor for something that we ought to be able to get away from, but don't. I mean, all you have to do is walk slightly faster than a zombie to get away. And he didn't call them zombies. He called them ghouls. But then the Variety magazines or the Hollywood magazines didn't quite know what to call them, so just used the word zombie, and the word stuck. And that came to be the zombies that we now think of when we watch movies like Resident Evil.
Wait a second. Does this mean Mr. Rogers wasn't real either? Is that what you're saying?
No, Mr. Rogers was absolutely real.
He was.
A cardigan sweater.
A really sweet guy.
It is Halloween, but I mean, do we know how many people? I know you're a zombie expert, not necessarily ghosts, goblins, ghouls, and you know, headless horseman expert.
Right.
But I mean, are people really genuinely, a lot of people concerned, you know, about all these things coming out tonight, Halloween night?
I don't think so. I mean, I think most of us have a good time with it.
Okay.
Like I said,
not 30%.
I get worried about the preppers. I think last year somebody on Halloween came to my house with a 13-year-old with a butcher knife, and I said, "No, you go home and you come back with a fake knife, and then you get your candy." But you're not carrying a butcher knife.
Do you live in Cambridge?
No, I live in Belmont.
Oh, they wouldn't do that in Cambridge.
Never in Cambridge. No. You know, as Steve Schlossman, the only thing odder to me. Or I don't know, or more troublesome to me than you doing a coast to coast show in the middle of the night. That is troubling. But putting that aside, how do you pronounce this? Ataxic neurodegenerative. What's that third word?
Satiety.
Satiety deficiency syndrome. ANSD. What happens if you Google that? Let's assume I heard this broadcast and I worried about contracting that.
Yeah, so after this thing happened, I did exactly that and recognized that the term itself, which I simply made up, had a life of its own on the internet. It has its own Wikia fan site. It has a Facebook page, which I did not create. Universities have done disaster drills using this disease, which I made up. It has some basis in science, like all science fiction, but it's not real.
Okay, Steve, you're the author of The Zombie Autopsy. It's going to be made into a movie, you think? We're big into zombies.
Oh, we're sure hoping the script's done and the agents have it. So.
Really?
Is that really so?
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so George Romero bought it, and so the guy who made Night of the Living Dead, the guy whose movie I snuck into, Dawn of the Dead, is the guy who owns
that's
it.
That's pretty good.
Now, do zombie movies ever make it to the Academy Awards, or is it kind of an outside shot?
World War Z might. They have largely been the sort of indie fun movies, and then only of late, Zombieland, I think, was the first real zombie blockbuster. Dawn of the Dead, an awful lot of money went into that for that particular genre. But Night of the Living Dead was made for almost nothing. And in fact, it's an eminent domain movie. He didn't copyright it.
Do you get to get a cameo role if the zombie autopsy gets made?
I hope so. The lines are simple. It's like, rrr. It's an easy
I think
line.
You could do that. Right. So let's end this with, what's the moral of this story? This coast-to-coast experience a couple of years ago in the middle of the night, 2 to 4 a.m. What's the moral? What's the takeaway, Steve?
I think actually it's a more profound takeaway than we realize. As we have, information does not equal knowledge. And so we've got all this information that's like a mile wide, but it's about a half inch deep. So we've got to get better at verifying what we think we know and being really careful to question that which we think we know so that we don't come to false conclusions. We don't believe what we think we already know. That's the rule.
By the way, just as an aside, I should ask you this. I assume you're working on some serum or something if I happen to contract ANSD.
You're pretty much ready.
Leave Jim your email, please, and your cell phone for an emergency.
Right, and not to sort of spill my politics, but it will be part of the Affordable Care Act.
Which means we'll never be able to get it.
No, you'll get it. I promise you'll get it. I'll have maybe a separate website. I don't know, but it'll happen.
Steve Schlossman, this is great. Thanks so much.
Steve is a practicing physician at MGH and an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and the author of the soon-to-be movie, now in book form, The Zombie Autopsies. Thank you very much for being with us today, Steve. And if you haven't got enough of your War of the World fix, tonight at 10 o'clock, we are broadcasting a Radio Lab special on War of the Worlds, which is going to be fantastic. When we come back, Chris Lydon joins us for Open Mic. We'll get his take on the theme of this year's mayoral race, upper class versus working class. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Now, joining us, as he does every Thursday for Open Mic, is Christopher Lydon. He's the man behind RadioOpenSource.org. Back in 93, when he ran for mayor, he asked this question. What is the question to which Tom Menino is the answer? Well, today we hope he will ask the question. What is the question to which John Connolly or Marty Walsh is the answer? Christopher Lydon, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jim and Marjorie.
You're still licking your wounds, or you're not, from 93? Got you. What plug?
No.
Plug whatever you want.
Total personal best. Great way to spend the summer. No, I just want to put in a plug. If you can't wait till 10 o'clock for GBH's War of the Worlds, come and hear ours live out at the Regent Theater on Medved Street in Arlington.
Oh, this is the Garen Daly organized thing that you're doing?
Oh, that's going to be fun.
Joyce Kohawick and the novelist Bill Martin and a few
others. Oh, that's great. What time is that again?
7:30. At the Regent Theater in Arlington.
You do that, and then you turn on WGBH. It's perfect. It's
unbelievable. And then vote your choice.
Exactly.
That's right. So what do you make of this whole theme, that John Connolly is the man of privilege and Marty Walsh is the working stiff's hero, and this is all about, the...
It's all distraction, of course. We got to get to it a little bit indirectly. First, I just want to say another little connection. I think the World Series win is great for the town. Seriously, I'm old enough to remember the 67 Impossible Dream Red Sox. That was the sort of the high that Kevin White floated into office on. And John Lindsay, 69, he got reelected on the Mets. On the Spirit. A victory like that, I think, even more than the whole Boston Strong thing,
John, I met John Lindsay, by the way, in the Catskills. One of the most impressive human beings.
No
and one of the most beautiful human beings.
Oh, I've always seen that. Oh, yeah.
Didn't your sister work for him, Margaret?
She did.
By the way, I was one of the first of my long string of totally incorrect predictions. It was totally clear to me John Lindsay was a future president of the United States. And, you know, he died in a fairly horrible, sad state of affairs. Not great
Parkinson's,
economic status. It was pretty sad.
Good public servant. And Kevin White thought the world of him. I discovered my own notes on Kevin White's. He thought John Lindsay was the best public servant in the country.
He was great.
In the late 60s. What's to say about Boston? The town is in great shape, and we're in transition. But transition to what? We really don't know. I want to talk to... And I listen to you guys. You've moderated a significant forum with both of them. I want to talk about the guys, but also, you know, let's talk measures and let's talk men. But first, the measures. I am struck by the kind of, dare I say, vacuous, almost emptiness, non-democratic, non-earthy, real quality of this thing on just the issues. And I
like
would
what?
Just say
give
three.
Us one. Okay,
well,
three.
There's a wonderful piece on the New Yorker online, but the Manhattanization of our city, starting, of course, with Manhattan. What does it mean? It means turning a city into a playground for the wealthiest inhabitants, even as it forgets about the poorest. And in New York, the wealthiest 1% of Manhattan earned nearly 40% of all the city's income. I mean, this is serious, and all of it applies to Boston. We have population growth among the poor. We have population growth among the very rich. But more and more of that old middle is missing, and it's what we love about Boston, those of us who grew up here.
Stay on the Manhattanization. You don't think these two guys have addressed, whether it's adequately for you or not, the whole question of poor people in the city moving to the middle class? I mean, for example, when they're not discussing the arbitration bill filed by Marty Walsh enough already, they're talking about the city schools. Aren't the city schools sort of the central
piece? They talk about it, but what are they saying, Jim? I'm not really hearing anything that addresses this. Nothing remotely. We've talked about de Blasio in New York, but there's an example there of putting a surtax on the incomes of people making $500,000 or more and putting it directly, you know, conserving it specifically for preschool education. That's symbolic, but it's also very real, and it's very
so. When you say you haven't heard anything either concrete or whatever other adjective you used, is it meaning? And we asked them this, and everybody else has asked too. All these wonderful programs, longer school day, universal pre-K, whatever it is, which they seem to agree upon, is what's missing is the payment. Meaning, if you don't describe how you pay for something, then all your prescriptions for fixing anything are ephemeral, or
First of all, I mean, I think there's just too much gab about other stuff. We don't know enough about the city we're living in. For example, Barry Bluestone at Northeastern, wonderfully useful researcher and citizen, has a new report out about housing. We know, of course, that poor people pay too much for their rent. But listen to this. In the year 2000, the people who were paying 30% or more of their income for rent were 40% of the population. Today, barely 10 years later, it's 51%. 51% are paying 30% of their income for housing. But then a lot of people pay half their income for housing.
Boston.
In Boston.
Yep.
In 2000, Boston people who were paying half of their income for housing were 18% of the population. Today, they're 26% of the population. This is a continuing trend, and it's important. And it's the point is, it's changing the character, the look, the feel, the self-estimation of the city itself.
So what are you saying, that the city is getting richer and richer and poor
the
and poor, and there's no middle class?
The divide is getting greater.
It's getting
But doesn't
polarized.
That get to the whole school thing? Because so many people that are – and when my children were young, you know, I was not making a lot of money, but we moved out of Boston because
– So many parents do.
Exactly. So I think that's –
Because of the schools. You should finish
the schools,
your sentence.
Because of the schools. And I think that's one of the things about fixing the schools, is that you would keep that middle class that would like to live in Rosendale, that would like to live in Hyde Park, that would like to live even Jamaica Plain, which is getting much more expensive, obviously, but they won't because of the schools. So that's how to get the middle class back to Boston, isn't it?
That's one of the key ways, maybe the key way. I admire John Conley for saying early on that, you know, that the target voter in this city this year is 40 with kids. And I think that would be a wonderful place to just focus the, you know, the campaign, but also where we're going to rebuild the city, and it includes the parks and the neighborhoods and the housing stock and the schools too.
But it's your criticism, just so I'm clear, it's your criticism that they're talking the talk but not walking the walk? Because, for example, in this whole issue about the neighborhoods, I think both of them have said it, I don't mean this critically, ad nauseum, I mean it as a compliment, that Boston can't just be about downtown. It's got to be about neighborhoods. It's a catchword that both of them use. Is they your concern that they're not, there's no meat on the bones? Is that what it
there's
is?
There's no meat on the bones. There's no follow through. There's no sense of, wait a sec, we're kind of in trouble in those neighborhoods, in those poor neighborhoods. And there are lots of them. I heard both of the candidates each speak for an hour last Saturday morning out at the Franklin Park Clubhouse. It was a good event, and probably 150 people sitting there with a tremendous. This is in Franklin Park, in the Olmsted, you know, the Green Belt, the whole thing. But they're talking about starting with Marty Walsh. They're talking about sort of these public-private partnerships to pick up and clean up and maintain smaller and larger parks around the city, which gets something like 0.5% of the city budget. I didn't hear a program there. I didn't hear a real investment. I didn't hear the city taking responsibility. Again, it's a lot of it. Let's have, you know, community cleanup days, and Marty Walsh always talks about what he does in Savin Hill, which is sort of interesting. The parks that Bill Walczak made sort of famous if you were watching his online ads, because he mows the grass himself. This is fine too, but what about
Walczak mows the grass himself in the parks?
In the public park in Savin Hill.
Wow, good for him.
Sounds a little Dukakis-like, does it not?
Yeah.
Picking
it does.
Up trash on the way to work at Northeastern.
It also sort of fudges the question about what is the city's responsibility. We pay substantial taxes for this kind of thing.
But you know why any candidate, and this is not at all critical of Connolly and Walsh, it's a statement of reality, the reason that public private partnerships are such a popular phrase and concept is it allows you to avoid the question of financing of most of these
financing
things.
And
for example, there's been nonstop
bottom line
talk
responsibility.
About the commuter rail stop, which is within earshot of where we are.
That's
here,
right.
Being a New Balance project. And it, the beauty of it, beyond the fact that apparently it is being paid for by New Balance, is the fact you don't have to talk about new tax dollars in the city.
There's also been nonstop talk about the fact that it is so difficult to start a business and to start a restaurant in some of these neighborhoods where you could have some really great restaurants, and how hard it is to get a liquor license. And there's almost no, if any at all, liquor licenses in Dudley Square, which is absolutely ridiculous. You know, I think that they always are hedging so much of their criticism, because that's a direct criticism of Tom Menino.
I think you're right.
Why do you have to go through 9,000 permitting processes and pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a liquor license? It's crazy. And think about how different Dudley would be and how different Upham's Corner would be and all those places would be if there were more restaurants with bars serving, you know, good food that you could come into and sit down and have a drink.
Right.
It would change everything.
Even more grocery stores.
Even more grocery stores.
This gets to I want to come back to what's missing. And you're pushing me, Jim, and you should, on what is actually missing. I think a simple declaration that we got a problem. We got a problem with inequality. That's the big difference in New York, where Bill de Blasio, who's going to be the mayor, says we've got an inequality crisis. We sort of mince around the edges of saying, oh, well, we'll do that and we'll have a little public partnership to clean up the park or something. But nobody's saying we have a fundamental disparity here.
They've used the term two Bostons, and to some of us, two Bostons, the thing that first comes to mind is a racial divide. I mean,
yes.
For example, public safety in communities of color versus wealthier white suburbs, downtown and other areas. But also, they have taught. Again, there may not be the meat on the bones that you or other voters are looking for. And I should say, of the three of us in the room, the only one who's voting in the election on Tuesday is Christopher Lydon. But they had the two Bostons to them. The discussion they had the other night with R.D. Salkris, I thought was about economic disparities and inequality, but apparently
they don't lead with it. One candidate told me his polling showed the number one issue all stems from inequality, and it has different forms, but people being squeezed out of the city. It's a very real thing, and every neighborhood knows these people whose income is not rising to match the value of the housing or the rent that they're paying. But I asked him why wasn't that the sort of the front end of your campaign. We've got to talk about inequality. And he said, well, it's too hard to explain or too hard to get people's attention. De Blasio, I mean, to me, this is the interesting thing this year. De Blasio is reminding us that, in fact, mayor's races and city halls are a terrific place to command the public attention. They are bully pulpits, and they're free. I mean, they're not – the next mayor of Boston has barely got a legislative problem. He's got a very friendly media around him. Let's surface the realities of urban life in America today and then and deal with a few more of them. Schools, I got to say one other thing, because I'm always pictured as sort of knocking schools. Actually, I think there are amazingly wonderful things going on in Boston public schools and charter schools and pilot schools and parochial schools too. One of them is right up the street here at the in the old Colum Kills school. There's behind in the back there, there's a conservatory lab charter school where every kid in K-1 spends 3 hours a day making music. I think we've spoken about this.
Yes.
It's a kind of music boot camp, and these are the happiest, most wonderful, you know, engaged, nourished, friendly, beaming kids of every stripe that you can imagine.
You know, let me mention
and it's also happening in the, in the straight old Boston Latin School and in others, but it's got to be spread out. It's got to be made brought to more attention, the creative possibilities, especially in letting kids come to grips with their expressive selves.
You know what mayoral candidate said to me the other day on television? That the only issue that mattered in this city was what you're talking about, poverty and economic justice. You know who it was?
Buddy Walsh.
Ray Flynn. Ray Flynn came on my show after
he was in
1983.
That was a trick
in the mayoral
question.
Debate. All he talked about, I mean, it's so interesting he said this. I mean, he talked about social and economic justice, and there's no number two issue. Michael Patrick McDonald, who we've had on the show, who obviously wrote All Souls, he tweets afterwards, wow, Mayor Flynn talking social and economic justice, saying that it all starts there. I'm actually liking him. He says, I'm forgetting that he and I were once enemies. And
well,
I have to say,
he's a big Catholic. But, you know, and I commend him for his talking about economic justice. But to me, the problem is there's no way right now for many kids to get any kind of economic justice because you cannot get an education and you cannot get your way out of poverty unless you can get an education. And there's all these kids in Boston aren't learning the right things or aren't learning vocational ed.
I just have to say there's not only an exception, but there's a model here in this Conservatory Lab Charter School. They level the playing field. Every kid in that school gets an instrument free, basically a violin or, you know, maybe a clarinet or a trumpet. But there is a social justice agenda written into that school. And some kids come from, you know, supportive families. Some kids, you know, are latchkey kids. They are well aware of that and they compensate. But every kid plays music, and they play music together in the most extraordinary fourth-grade orchestra you're ever going to hear. The point is, you know, people argue charter schools, is this skimming? Is it union busting? No, it's lighting. If we play it right, if the mayor plays it right, it's making models that every single school in this city can
copy. Well, that's a critical issue. It has to be transferable. I mean, that's the issue.
It's got to be, you know.
Well, how many times has Deval Patrick said there's all these jobs available and we don't have the people to fill them because
240,000 jobs?
Yes, because young people are not getting the education, and that's right across the Commonwealth. So, I mean, to me, if you can prepare people and keep people in school until late in the day and do all these things that they're talking about, both of them, the longer school days and better teaching, which is critical, that's the ticket.
Hey, Chris Lydon.
Go ahead.
We have John Connolly in studio with us tomorrow. We have Marty Walsh on the phone.
The Globe endorsed John Connolly.
On Monday.
The Herald endorsed John
Connolly.
Yes, we both did.
But the 7 point behind John Connolly, too.
Tell us what is the single most important question we should ask Connolly and ask Walsh tomorrow and Monday.
Well, it's funny.
That you think is going unanswered.
Who the hell are you? seriously. I mean, they both are so locked into their self-presentation now. I want to know more about their cronies, their best friends, their lawyers, you know, their staff people. Who's going to be there? Who do they talk to late at night? What's their pleasure? I was going to ask you guys. You spent more FaceTime with both of them than I have. What do we think of these guys? I mean, again, they fall into stereotypes. They're the two Irish guys who...
Just read that about Walsh there, about the BRA. It's in the Herald this morning.
But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, we're famous now for having, again, yet again, an all green, as they used to say, Irish choice here. But they're very different, and they are sort of stereotypical guys. I mean, Marty Walsh is the Ray Flynn of this moment, sort of east of Dorchester Avenue, Boston working class guy, very Irish. I love his line saying, Castle Island was our Cape Cod growing up. But, you know, the working stiff, recovering alcoholic, it's interesting that that got such a play in the New York Times.
New York Times. Did you see that story?
Yes,
you
I
talked
did.
A lot about it,
yes,
and, of course, it violates the first doctrine of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Exactly.
That you don't talk about it. But in any event, and then, you know, John Connolly's wife had to answer with her ordeal with cancer. This is getting pretty poisonal and, I should say, silly.
But Chris Lydon, you just said 2 minutes ago, tell us who you are. And I think knowing Marty Walsh a little bit, I don't know, I just met John Connolly's wife the other day, so I don't know how much she identified right before the debate that with her life. That is a huge part of who Marty Walsh is. And while some people think he came out to on that issue to Von Abraham basically to get that out in the world so that he wasn't attacked with it, I mean, that to me says a lot, and he says it repeatedly in debates, maybe for political advantage. I think it says a lot about who he is as a human being, no?
But I think, you know, when I was listening to him on Saturday morning, there's just too much. We want to know more about the man, but there's too much about sort of the personality. He's always talking about Savin Hill. It's tough to get him beyond sort of the little, you know, the little league ball field and the trees on his street and this kind of thing. I don't hear much about the rest of the city at large, the cities in America in 2013. I don't see a plan. I don't feel a network. Not that I want him to be a leader of a gang. Everybody holds him responsible for being a union guy, but who does he know? Who is he going to call on? Who are the people going to be the strong men of that government? And I say,
That's a great question, by the way, which we should ask, is who are the one or two people, as you put it, Chris, who do you call late at night? That's a very...
Well, you know, it's funny. I broke in with Kevin White, and in fact, I introduced him to his decisive staff guy, Barney Frank. I worked Barney Frank into that campaign.
That's
and
then,
of course, he took over this old City Hall. But he had amazingly strong people around him, including Hale
Champion.
And
that's one of the other big things that was a big criticism of Menino, is that he didn't want people around him that were very strong, that were going to threaten him running the show. I mean, that's
one of the criticisms of Barack Obama as well.
Right. Well, it's true. Barack Obama and both of our candidates for mayor have never run anything, in fact. I mean, they've never had a kind of major executive.
Well, that's not true. Marty Walsh ran this big piece of building trades. He's taking a lot of heat for it, but he did run the building trades, which is a huge operation. That's the thing as we learned the other night, he made $175,000, as if that's a sin committed by Marty Walsh that he made a decent salary. But
I'm just talking about running a large public enterprise. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't have to be Dwight D. Eisenhower and D-Day, but I mean, some significant public project to be judged on. I mean, did you say also about John Connolly? I mean, there are a lot of stereotypes there. He is the Kevin White of this moment. He's the West Roxbury child of a political family, politics, politics, politics. Smart guy, Roxbury Latin. I can't hold that against him. Harvard.
We spoke the other day. One of the great experiences. Marjorie and I spoke at an event.
I sent my kids
great.
There too. Actually,
Roxbury Latin.
What a fabulous
it's a great place.
Oh my god, great place. So, Chris Lydon, let's get to the bottom line here before we bid you adieu. As I said, you're the only person voting on Tuesday in Boston. Who are you voting for?
I don't think I'm going to say, Jim.
I had a feeling that might be the answer. Have you made up your mind?
I get a absolutely.
Okay.
I get a pollster call every hour on the hour.
People I'm going to call you in an hour.
Bangladesh thing. How certain are you to vote? but no, I don't want to.
It's fine.
It's not of any interest, really. But these are both capable guys, but I want to hear much, much more about the city. Here's something I might ask him, Jim. You know, we take the political history of the city of Boston very seriously in this town. Who are your models, including, John F. Fitzgerald or John Collins or Kevin White? And what about Menino? To me, this is the fascinating core difference with our race and the New York race. Something changed in the weather in New York, and they said, Bloomberg, enough already. A billionaire buys this office 3 terms and makes it comfortable for people like him. And you know, de Blasio is founded on an anti-Bloomberg sentiment.
Yeah, but
I think there's a a latent but strong feeling enough already with Tom Menino doing pretty much the same thing. He's not a multi-billionaire.
But there's one major difference. When de Blasio decided that it was wise to take on Bloomberg, Bloomberg's popularity was on the wane in New York City. Tom Menino's popularity is anything but on the wane
in
Boston.
I'm not so sure in terms of what he's done. Again, not only the inequality crisis, but for example, you know, I heard Marty Wells speaking, you know, saying the arts and culture, we got to build up that side of the public ledger. But what about design standards? What about the waterfront, which to me, from a design standpoint, was a complete waste, unbelievably valuable real estate right smack in the city of Boston. When I ran for mayor, I was saying, look, if we can't think of a better way to develop it, just reproduce the Back Bay, you know, with housing. And Jimmy Kelly, of course, didn't want any new voters.
Marty Walsh wants to tear down City Hall.
I know, this is...
They should tear down the Moakley Courthouse if they want to tear down something so people can get...
But I say, and nobody has contradicted me, Mayor Menino has been there 20 years. Is there a building in this town that is the marker of that long regime? Kevin White was a builder. James Michael Curley was a fantastic builder.
How about the ICA?
The ICA.
That's true. That's new.
Maybe he gets, yeah. I don't know that it's a great building.
Don Shafara wanted to build a lot of buildings, but it never quite worked out for him.
But I'm talking, ICA.
We're
going
to ask him. You have my word. If you listen tomorrow at about 1:20 and you listen on Monday, much of the Chris Lydon agenda will be aired in depth.
Hey, before you
get to ask him what happened to the de Blasio effect in Boston. One of those two candidates said to me, Chris, it's here, and I have the same consultants that de Blasio has, but why don't we hear about it? Why don't we hear an aggressive plan to tackle, be a model for the country, a little anvil of urban democracy on the biggest issue in the blinking world, Jim,
got it,
which is polarization of wealth.
Got
Christopher
it.
Lydon should have run again for mayor. I think that's clearly...
It's not too late.
Not too late.
Not this time.
You can always write in Chris Lydon, and you can also come and see us at the Regent Theater in Arlington.
That's tonight. 7:30 tonight on the War of the Worlds. Christopher Lydon joins us every Thursday at 1. And when we come back, we are asking you when it comes to trick or treating, because today is Halloween, in case you forgot. How old is too old? That's next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. As Marjorie said, it is Halloween, in case you forgot. And we're going to tackle a couple of the toughest issues you have to tackle. When it comes to giving out candy, what are your criteria? Are kids 18 and up off limits? How about if they're 6'3 and weigh 250? How about people who don't even, this is a big one, don't even put in the effort to wear a costume? And the flip side is, are you guilty of overage trick-or-treating? The number is 877-301-8970. We want standards. We want you to help us, and we'll help you as well. We'll give you a little guidance as to when the person comes to the door, when do you just say no. I'll give you another example, Marjorie.
What's that, Jim?
If the trick-or-treater is wearing a beard that he grew in solidarity with the Red Sox, and he is too old to be trick-or-treating. And by the way, the pet peeve I have, when someone comes, and they, as I said a minute ago, and they don't even put in the effort to
So what do you do?
Put a lumberjack's hat on.
When that person comes,
you called 911. And you said, it's tough. It is really tough, but there should be self-policing. And the number is 877-301-8970. What are your criteria for giving, for handing out treats on Halloween? And I would say the age is getting older. Would you not agree with that? People are trick-or-treating older and bigger,
yeah,
and they shouldn't.
Forget it. As soon as you start to grow, I mean, you have people come to the door, and you're right, they're 6'2". I mean, forget it. No, you're not getting any candy. That's it. And also, you can't give them any candy. They have no outfit on. And also, in case people haven't heard this, this is the best story of all this
Halloween. This is your column?
Yeah. This is
unbelievable.
If you haven't heard this, listen to this.
Unbelievable.
There's this woman from Fargo, North Dakota. Assuming she's real, this could have been a hoax as well, but assuming she's real, this lady calls this local station in Fargo, North Dakota, and says she's going to be handing out fat letters instead of candy to trick-or-treaters she deems overweight.
I think it's got to be a
hoax. Here's
your
letter. Your child is, in my opinion, moderately obese and should not be consuming sugar and treats to the extent of some this Halloween season. My hope is you step up as parents and ration candy this Halloween.
You know what that means? Had I been that kid at the door, I would never have gotten a piece of candy when I was young. That can't be true. It can't be true.
You know, it's not that crazy because you think there's all this sort of regulating Halloween going on. Lots of schools, no costumes.
I know you told me that today.
No candy. Forget about it.
Is that for religious reasons or for health reasons?
A couple of years ago in Newton, it was because some families objected. They didn't like the religious overtones of Halloween. I don't think most of us think of Halloween as a religious holiday, but they didn't like that. So Newton put the X-Day on the kids marching around in their costumes. The teachers marched around in Newton, I think, and the kids were in Raynham. A lot of schools in Brookline, they don't, at least in the school near me, there's no Halloween celebration. Ixnay.
You know what should happen?
We're supposed to be giving out carrots now because Michelle Obama says that we're all too fat, which we are. And you know what happens to Sasha Malia?
No.
They get to keep their bag. Not in their room. They get to keep their bag for 1 day or 2 days, and then she takes it.
Good for her.
She takes it, and they can't keep it in their room.
Let me tell you, there was nothing more fun when I was a kid when you got to someone's door and they gave you an apple. I mean, is there a kid? Oh, I love apples, by the way, but is there a kid alive? And thank God for the fact that somewhere in Kansas every year, and please take this in the right spirit, people, that somebody put a razor blade in an apple, because as long as it happened once every year or two, then people wouldn't give out apples.
Wait a minute. I don't think anybody's ever found a razor blade in their apple.
Well, then it's apocryphal. It's fine with me. I don't care.
Bill Weld gave out apples.
Yeah.
I remember going over when he was the governor of the Commonwealth, going over to his house there on Fairweather Street in Cambridge.
I was with you, Marjorie. We were outside the door.
No, that was the day we were looking for the garbage. We went through his garbage.
We were supposed to meet Michael Moore that night outside his house, actually. She never showed up.
Jim going through that garbage.
I did.
It was disgraceful.
Yeah,
he didn't even have rubber gloves on or anything. No, this is the night he was trick or treating. It became a big issue in the race between John Kerry and Bill Weld
for
Senate because over in Lewisburg Square, the maid was giving out candy at the Teresa Hines John Kerry abode. Meanwhile, over in Cambridge,
bobbing for
Mr.
apples.
And then Mrs. Weld had a bobbing for apples thing in the foyer of their.
But isn't the end of that story? Didn't after the press? I mean this sincerely. After the press got a hold of the bobbing for apples and the maid, didn't John Kerry apparently run home
they
or something
home.
So that he and Therese could hand out 877-301-8970. We want quick calls. We want to know what's the criteria. And Marjorie makes a good point. If you say that there's like a height thing or if you require kids to bring ID so you can find out how old they are, what do you do when they violate the criteria you've established?
Clearly they're going to vandalize your house.
Exactly.
You tell them. You know, the other thing is I can't
what's
stand.
That?
I won't bring up UNICEF today, Jim, and embarrass you. But when kids come to your house, they want money from UNICEF and they want candy. Hmm. When my kids are little, it's one or the other. One or the other. You can't be asking for money and candy
okay,
at the same time.
Let's get this off the table.
And make your big sacrifice on behalf of all the people.
When
that
I was a
UNICEF
little
money.
Child, when I was very
That's
small,
right. Tell this disgraceful
I did.
Story.
I did. I took the UNICEF money 1 year. It was like $4.
He took
and by the way, what I would
UNICEF
like to say,
because
Marjorie only tells half the story as she is wont to do, it is true. I admit it. Guilty as charged. I took the money. How do you know about it? How do you know about it?
Because
I admitted
it.
And after I confessed it a couple of years ago on my award-winning show on NECN, I had the regional head of UNICEF. What did I do on the air, Marjorie? Gave her a check for $100.
That's right. The check was about 3 feet by 5 feet.
It was large. 877.
He wanted everyone to know he was making up his stealing from UNICEF.
877-301-8970. What are your criteria trick or treaters when they come to your door? Let's go to Joe and Maynard. You were first on Boston Public Radio. Help us out, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
14 is definitely the cutoff age.
I'm with you.
How do you know? How do you know they're 14, Joe?
I'm sorry?
How do you know they're 14?
Oh, I don't know. I wish I could ID him. But I actually wanted to point out, I live in Holden, and the town has a curfew. When I moved to Holden, it was 8 o'clock. They just bumped it to 7 o'clock. And that really is, it keeps all the older kids away. It's just little kids that come to our door. So it's very nice, and it works well.
Well, the beauty, if you have a curfew at 7, just make sure you don't get home till like 7:05. And yourself.
We're going out to dinner tonight.
Joe, thank you for the call. You know, I do think it's hard to set an age, but there's an age for everything, for when you can buy cigarettes. Do you know that Bloomberg wants to raise the cigarette purchasing age in New York City to 21, which is great?
He's your mayor, Jim.
Okay,
he's
you can
mayor.
Vote at 18. Why can't there be a cutoff age, like Joe from Maynard just said? 14, 15, 16 years old, you can't go trick-or-treating anymore.
No, they're the ones, the older kids, the ones are supposed to be, you know, toilet papering everything and getting everybody with the shaving cream. That's what they're supposed to be doing. That's what you're going for door-to-door.
Fine, exactly.
At that age. Dylan from Providence. What do you think, Dylan?
Well, I really hope that there isn't a cutoff age because I'm 25 and I have my costume ready to go for tonight.
What are you dressing up as? I'm afraid to ask, Dylan.
I'm dressing up as Fred from Scooby-Doo. My girlfriend's going as Daphne. And we both are pretty baby-faced. We look really young, so I just got to make sure I shave and, you know, all the candy I can hold, which is a lot more than a 10-year-old can.
Now, Dylan, you're 25. What is the age at which you are thinking of stopping doing? By the way, it's getting dressed up is great. Going to a party dressed up is great. The trick-or-treating is the issue. What is the age, the cutoff age for you personally, would you say?
For me personally, to give out candy or when I'm going to stop going?
And when you stop going, that's the issue.
As soon as I can stop getting away with it.
Okay.
For me right now, once I have kids, I'll go with them. But the beauty of being 25 and doing it is that if you end up at a house party, you can ask them for a beer and show them your ID, and sometimes they'll give it to you.
Dylan, you're a man with a plan. Thank you.
Have a wonderful night trick-or-treating down
there. But he's baby-faced. He'll be fine.
He's baby-faced. That's right. Yeah, it's true. Sometimes you can't tell, you know, because they've got masks on.
That's a very good point.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of the mask,
exactly.
Is it not?
Exactly. So they try to fool you.
So what do you do? In all seriousness, let's assume you think someone is 20 and you really believe you should be serving young teens and single-digit people.
I make a joke and try to humiliate them.
And if you don't, you give them, right?
Aren't you a little bit old for this now that you know come straight from having a couple of beers down in the corner and now you're up your ass?
And when the kid says, are you talking to me, lady? You give them the stuff, right?
Well, that's the thing. You never know if they, pull out a six-shooter and it's going to be the OK Corral right there on your front porch. Let's go to Ed in Randolph. What do you think, Ed?
My wife and I decided a couple of years ago that we were getting a little bit sick and tired of kids showing up who didn't have any costumes at all.
So horrible.
We didn't have a problem really with the age. Most of them were young. We did find that some of the teenagers would show up and they wouldn't have any costumes. So my wife devised a system. This was brilliant thinking on her part. That's why I married her. Definitely my better.
Do tell the system.
She said the system is we have the separate bowl of candy, which is the chump candy. And what it is last year it was individually wrapped Lifesavers.
This is
year,
great.
Appropriately enough, it's Dum Dums.
She is a genius.
That's
Ed.
Great.
That is fabulous, actually. That is really creative. Ed, thank you. She's quite the innovator. Let's go to Nancy in Swansea. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's your plan, Nancy?
Well, I have to say the last call is funny because I do the same thing. If they don't come with a costume, I have a separate bowl with cheaper candy.
Really?
I don't even want to put an effort into it because I put an effort into it and dress up every year to sit on the porch and hand it all out. With my house all decorated inside and out.
So. Oh, good for you.
Yeah, I just love it. I'm like one of the kids that I get dressed and go to work.
Now, Nancy, is there a cutoff point for people coming to your house? Putting aside the issue of no costumes, is there a cutoff age or size or whatever?
No, I give out to the grandparents and everything. I just think it would be nice if they police themselves and just quit at 16 or...
Yeah.
But
you'll give it to anybody.
I give it to grandmas.
Okay,
and
fine. What's your address, Nancy?
Outside, in many years, I put out my popcorn machine. I have a big
popcorn machine.
I do that. Sometimes I don't because, like tonight, I have to go to work. But I'll give out the popcorn bags, fill the bags up with popcorn, and they'll drive around. And if I ain't got it prepared for them, they'll say, we'll come back, and they'll be yelling out the window. Hey, I need one for my grandma. It's like, come on up.
You're a good soul, Nancy. Nancy, thank you for the call. That's sort of the essence, the spirit of Halloween.
Yeah, well, some people really do go crazy. You know, they have coffins, and the father will pop out of the coffin as the kids walk up on the porch, and they've got, hands that you can stick your hand in.
Oh, like under the garage. Oh, how about under the garage door when the hand is sticking out?
Oh, yeah, that's really great, too. You know what they're doing now that's a big thing? The dentist buybacks. The dentists are buying back the candy so the kids all get it.
There was a big thing. There's a suburban guy in suburban Boston
cavities.
Did that,
But one of them was criticized for saying he's going to buy back the candy and then give it to a homeless shelter because you're giving it to the kids who, may not have...
No, the guy was in the news a couple of years ago. Was sending it to the troops in Iraq or Afghanistan, which is pretty great.
And then there was one of these other suggestions. I can't imagine anyone really doing this, but there's a suggestion online that what you do is you unwrap all the candy, throw out the candy, and make Christmas crafts from the leftover wrappers.
Oh, let me tell you, there's nothing I would like more than some wraps... folded, maybe origamied into Christmas. That would be a fabulous thing.
Wouldn't that be great in your Christmas stocking?
Let's take one more.
Okay, let's go to Linda in Boston. Hi, Linda.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
happy Halloween. I just want to say when I was growing up, there was a woman in my hometown who had a sign, like those Disney rides, that said, you must be this tall to trick-or-treat at this house.
That's not true.
It is true, and it was about the height of maybe a someone who just turned 12.
That is what town did you grow up in, Linda?
In Pennsylvania.
Where?
Western.
Western PA. That is fabulous. I love that.
That is a great idea. It's like the Ronald McDonald's in the playground. You have to be a certain height, under a certain height to go play in the Ronald McDonald's.
Yeah.
Or like the balls with all those diseases at McDonald's. You know, those things. You have to get a shot before you get in. I'm sorry, Linda.
Say that when I was growing up, my mother, I would come home with a bag of candy, and my mother would say, okay, pick your three favorite things. I would pick the three things. She would take the bag. I would never see the rest of the candy again. But I got to say, I do not have a single, nor have I ever had a cavity.
Linda is Michelle Obama's third child. Linda, thank you for the call. Is it great when your kids were younger? Same with mine. And I did this when I was a kid. How much fun is it when they separate the candy? When they unload the candy on the floor in the living room, 3,000 pieces of candy, and then they spend hours. There's nothing else they'd spend hours doing. Separated. Oh,
they
my
do.
God. It
and
doesn't
then,
get much better than
of
that.
Of course, after they go to bed, then you go through the candy yourself, and you take out your favorite Halloween candy.
Do you like Milky
Way's? Favorite?
I like Milky Way's Frozen.
Not Milky Way's.
Frozen.
No.
What?
Butterfingers. And Reese's.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Those are my favorites. I really like those. Take those chocolate things. Okay.
I mean, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm just gonna shave tonight and go out and see if I can get lucky.
Oh no, Jim! I don't think you're gonna fit under any signs, vertically or horizontally, even. Perhaps. Okay. When we come back, we're gonna look at innovations in transportation with a focus on why the United States is so far behind so much of the rest of the world. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. When it comes to advances in rail service, and Marjorie and I both love trains, is the Acela as good as it's ever going to get? Is high-speed rail potentially a part of our future? Joining us to talk on innovation in transportation is Kara Miller, who came to work today in a pink cowboy hat, the host of the Innovation Hub. You looked marvelous, Kara.
A pink, sparkly cowboy hat and
great.
A holster. Actually, my husband was putting together the holster and the gun for me yesterday, and he said, I don't think this is made for left-handed people. And I said, I think that's okay because I don't think I'll be using the gun. So it worked out fine.
You're left-handed too, like Margaret.
Yeah.
You should do that some week.
I know. A lot of special people are left-handed.
Very many of us. What is it, 9%?
Something like that. Yeah, Barack Obama.
So you spoke with Ed Rendell, former mayor of Philadelphia and former governor of Pennsylvania. And he had this great story. He tells this great story about this app that you can use in traffic. Tell us about that.
Yeah,
please.
So it's this app called I'm Stuck. And basically, exactly. And he has partnered with former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, current mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg. And basically, if you look at our transportation system in the U.S., it is a mess, especially when you compare us to other countries. And the implications of that are actually real. They're in the billions of dollars. People spend a tremendous amount of time caught in traffic. The average person spends almost 40 hours a year just idling, just doing nothing, spending time in traffic. Almost $1,000 out the window just the time that you spend idling your car in traffic. So there's real implications, right? You're not at the office at that time, all that.
How fast do you get stuff to market? I mean, there are huge implications.
Absolutely, absolutely. So he has launched this app called I'm Stuck, and the idea essentially is to tell Congress, to tell the president, to tell your senators, the people in the House of Representatives who represent you, that our transportation system is a disaster. Now, I have to say, I am personally skeptical that this Congress can get anything done and can agree to really fund transportation. But when you really look at, like I said, where we are in terms of innovative countries in this area, like Japan and China, we're really behind.
You know, and the notion, we talked to Deval Patrick about this very subject just last week when he was here. He wanted $1 billion for transportation infrastructure, a huge percentage of it was just to ensure the bridges don't fall down and the roads are repaired. Forget expansion. But when, if you were to stop the average person in the street and said, would you not love high-speed rail? Would you not love to be able to get on a train, not have to go through TSA and whatever in Boston and get to Washington on a train that went 200 miles an hour? I assume everybody'd say yes, but it is the prospect, despite the Rendells and Schwarzeneggers and Bloomberg, is virtually zero in this world, in the United States, is it not?
I agree with you that it's very unlikely we're going to get high-speed rail anytime soon, even though there have been, you know, plan after plan after plan for implementing high-speed rail. In a sense, the Northeast Corridor is perfect for it. We're very densely packed, and the cities are very close together. Yeah. I was actually doing some math this morning looking at the current railroads in Japan, right? So if you took the speeds of the current railroads in Japan and you wanted to get from Boston to New York, it would take you just under 2 hours.
Wow.
Can you imagine getting on, no security, right? Get on at 8 in the morning. At 9:50, you're walking out in New York.
It's like cutting the speed in half and then some.
Yes, and what you realize is that somebody who has a meeting in New York, instead of spending 8 hours on the train, which is basically what you're doing now, an entire day lost to get to that meeting, you could do it, get to the meeting, get back, and have half the day to be productive. I just have to say, that is the old Japanese train. Japan is currently working on a new train where you'd be in New York in under an hour.
How fast was it? Like 220 or something?
That's over 300 miles an hour.
Over 300 miles an hour?
Yeah. So currently they go about 200 in Japan. They've been doing that for years. That is like old school Japanese
technology. You know, I hesitate
to
say this. Whenever I mention anything that happened to me in Western Europe, Marjorie goes, oh, Jim was in Western Europe. But I'm going to do it anyway. About 15 years ago when I was in France, I was on...
It was 6 months ago.
TGV.
You
know what TGV stands for?
No.
Très grande vitesse.
Oh, the très grande vitesse.
Very high speed. It is... and that was only like 120 miles an hour. It was a long time ago. It is. It changes every. And by the way, you only live so long. Forget the economy. The ability to get from here to there quickly. You know what's horrible, though? On this high-speed thing, I've mentioned to our colleagues a couple of minutes ago at our pod, CNN did this wonderful piece on the Anderson Cooper show where they went to Ray LaHood, who was the Secretary of Transportation. He was the Republican. Everybody picks somebody from the other party these days to show they're bipartisan. He was a congressman from Indiana, Republican, who was picked to be head of transportation for Barack Obama. They appropriated something like $12 billion for high-speed rail. They'd spent $800 million on one particular project. All they used every penny on was to speed up old trains by an average of 10 minutes per trip. So they essentially wasted almost $1 billion that could have gone to something that the people could rally around. So, you know, the issue on this, I'm obsessed with this. I'm so glad you're talking about it. How do you change the mentality? Patrick, wait, let me finish this one thought.
Okay,
Deval Patrick
said, I'll tell you the problem.
Deval Patrick, we mentioned in 2007 or 8, there was a bipartisan Republican, Democratic, Business, Labor, Transportation, Finance Commission that said, let's raise the gas in Massachusetts, raise the gas tax, raise $1 billion. Everybody agreed. And then when the rubber hit the road, and I do mean that as a pun, half those people didn't even support Deval Patrick supporting exactly what they had done. I thought that was the perfect framework to get something. How do you create the critical mass of support to do anything more than ensure bridges don't fall down on top of us?
The I'm stuck thing, if it gets anywhere, the idea that you'd be constantly letting your politicians know that you're upset about this. But I think one of the problems is in Massachusetts, even though people were pretty happy with Deval Patrick's ideas, I mean, the Boston Herald, conservative paper, I mean, even in our poll and our investigation,
supported
the tax increase because the roads are so bad and the bridges are so bad. But there's a big corruption problem, the big dig fatigue around here, where the it started out, what was it? How many billion did it start at? 2 and wound up at 16. 15 or 16. And you have all these stories about, you know, people moving dirt from Quincy to Braintree to Quincy to Braintree, back where just moving dirt around, you know, making all this money. So, and the taxpayers getting stuck with that. They have to really clamp down in some ways in these building projects because people are just going to think, we're going to get raked over the coals once again.
He was a mayor of my hometown. I know him a very tiny little bit. He's a real-world politician. He's not a dreamer. So other than I'm stuck, what's his prescription to get from here to there?
Well, okay, so he has a couple things, I would say. One is, you know, he cites these times, which, you know, I talked about being able to get in a couple hours to New York without any hassle. New York is even closer to Philly. You'd be able to get there in 25 minutes on a high speed.
Can you imagine?
25 minutes?
Yeah, so you could just live in New York and work in Philly or whatever. You could get from Washington to New York in under an hour. It's actually closer, Washington. I mean, so these are incredible things. So one of the things he says is, okay, there's actually a Japanese company that is interested in building a test line. And this is one of the things you do. You build a short line so people say, fall in love with it. And they're interested in building it from D.C. to Baltimore's airport. It would take 6 minutes to get.
How long does it take now?
An hour in traffic.
Oh, man.
Right? 6 minutes. And actually, I have ridden on the maglev train that goes from Shanghai to Shanghai Airport, which is they are nowhere near each other. They are very, very far apart. It takes 8 minutes. And, you know, you can read anything. You can drink anything on this. I mean, nothing will spill. It is essentially a maglev train is actually this kind of magnetic thing where you're actually floating over the rail. So there is never any sort of herky jerkiness to it.
Okay.
It was amazing.
Then when you look out the window in a train that's going 300 miles an hour, is it just a big blur or can you actually see things?
No, because if you look at things far away, it's like when you're in an airplane, can you see things?
Okay.
Right?
That's a very good
point. You look
point.
At things very close, you can't really see them, but you can see the countryside going by very clearly.
Is this Japanese thing something that they would privately finance? Is that the notion?
I think it would be a public-private partnership. That's what Rendell thinks. There's no way, a la the big dig, that we can just do it as a public thing. But if we can get a public-private partnership, and if you can imagine, you know, businesses wanting workers to be
able to
get from D.C.
That's
to Philly
New Balance
in 20
is doing
minutes.
The commuter rail thing
exactly,
here?
Because it is awful to have people. You know, I'll tell you another thing, too, that Rendell said that I think is a great point. The reason we have so many airline delays is because we have all these darn shuttles taking people from Boston to New York and from Boston to Washington. But if you got there faster on a train, then why would you take a shuttle? And if we didn't have the shuttles, then you could actually get from Boston to L.A. without being the seventh plane to take off. You know how they say, we are seventh in line.
Yeah,
like, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's take a couple of calls. William, you're in Connecticut, and you are on Boston Public Radio with Kara Miller. Hi, William.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Okay, I have used the train from D.C. to Providence, Rhode Island.
Yeah.
And my wife is going down there to see our daughter this weekend. It's a 130 round trip. Now she made her ticket way in advance. That's why it's cheaper. It's about 120 or so if you don't do it ahead. But it's nice. It's really literally 8 hours, and it's clean. It's underused, and that's like two tanks of gasoline, and the tolls. And no, I like it.
But it's
and,
8 hours.
That's a long time. 8 hours, though, right?
Yeah, but 8 hours is if you fly low. That takes you to D.C., okay?
Yeah.
But so if you thought about driving to the airport, that takes another hour flight. You might save 2 hours, I think, when all of a sudden benefits take the plane, maybe three. But
One of the reasons Marjorie and I often, when we go, I know you go, you take Amtrak. When I go, I take Amtrak because you avoid that. But what Kara's talking about, what Rendell's talking about, and thanks for the call, William, is you can speed up the journey itself in huge, huge ways.
And that's right. Now it is a little bit of half a dozen the other, trying to figure out whether you take a plane and go through security and the whole hassle, or whether you do Amtrak and that's many hours going to New York. But if you could just eliminate the hassle and be there in under 2 hours, and that's using the technology that's been used. That's not like, if we could only come up with the technology. That's using technology that's been used in Japan for years, in which they're sort of over, like I said, and they're working on something that's a lot faster, and you'd be in New York in under an hour on the train.
You know what's really depressing in this story that Ed Rendell wrote, too, that when people list in these different surveys the best airports in the world, we're not even in the top 25.
I know.
I mean,
Singapore is number one.
You go to other countries and you think, wow.
Yeah.
And we're supposed to be this big powerhouse here, richest country in the world, and you think, ugh.
Tom Friedman once wrote a great column. I think he was going from Hong Kong to like JFK, and he said it felt like he was traveling from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. And it made him
really
depressed. You know, you go from somewhere where there's Wi-Fi everywhere and there's, you know, glass and you're taken off really quickly and you end up in JFK.
Yeah. Well, I mean, our priorities are different. I think we spend money on lots of other things.
Right. I think we're not that great at thinking about big projects and like long term things. I mean, a train line does not get built in a day.
Well,
right?
That's your
argument.
And
it's very expensive.
That's your argument all the time about politicians. It's what's going to happen today, not what's going to happen in five years, 10 years, 15 years.
My argument is they don't fix anything that is not going to fall apart on their, unless it's going to fall apart on their watch. Whether it's Social Security or transportation, they make a calculation, even if it's not conscious. If this thing is not going to implode, if the bridge is not going to fall down literally or figuratively, or if Social Security is not going to lose its money while I'm still in office, then let the next guy or woman deal with it. And sadly, I think this transportation stuff, which makes total sense and is a perfect opportunity for the infamous public-private partnerships, because of what you said, how important it is for business. And you would hope those business guys, who generally like Republicans more than Democrats, would lobby the Republicans who won't spend a penny on anything and say, this is good for our side.
Well, I think people are also bad at looking at the big picture. I mean, in fact, defense contractors are great at understanding this. So, you know, when you're building a big plane, the idea is to try to get one little piece of the plane built in every single district in the U.S., right? So that every single congressional person says, yep, we're totally for it, because we, you know, we make the ashtrays or something.
Let's squeeze this one in, quickly.
One more call. We only have a few seconds left. It's Leon from Boston. I hope I pronounced that right.
Hi, Leon. Got to be quick. Right. Go.
Okay.
You're on.
Yeah, I'm from Boston. I'm actually Chinese. Like I said to the lady, I just answered my phone call. I was in China when I about 10 years ago. There was no high-speed train, and we are pretty much like the train station, train level. But after several years, the government started to build the high-speed system, and I thought that was stupid because it's too expensive. Most people don't need that. But right now, I actually enjoy the high-speed system because it's really, really fast, and it's not too cheap for like middle class. And when you time, we don't care about too much about money. And the money is, from my point of view, it's not expensive. It's about like $40.
And you also say you're concerned about the time, which is, Leon, thank you for the call. That's exactly my take. It's great that it's good for the economy. It's great it's going to save me money. More importantly, I want to save time.
That's
I don't want to be traveling
right.
for days to get from here to there. It's fabulous.
You know, I've been on those trains that Leon's been on, and they are amazing. Now, China has some advantages, like not being a democracy in terms of getting things done.
democracy either. What's tonight and what's Saturday?
Tonight we're looking at the future of the blockbuster, and Saturday we're talking to Dan Pink, very interesting guy, the science of persuasion.
Oh, I love that.
Ooh, excellent.
Yeah.
Kara Miller is the host of Innovation Hub. You can catch her, as she just said, tonight at 9 o'clock, Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. Mayoral candidate John Conley joins us. In our Friday news quiz, we have two local mystery writers, Hank Philippi Ryan and B.A. Shapiro, take on this week's headlines. Our show is a production of WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Browdy, and Marty Walsh is coming Monday, so don't get nervous. We are going to be fair.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks for listening.